بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون. In this verse of the Holy Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, it is He who has sent His apostle with guidance and the religion of truth, that He may make it prevail over all religion, even though those who worship false gods may detest it. Even though America, Russia, and all the superpowers may detest it, Allah's promise is not conditional on the strength of the superpowers. In its widest sense, the Islamic movement spans the entire Ummah. In its narrowest, it represents that part of the Ummah which is most advanced in its struggle towards establishing Islam as a total way of life. A few years ago, one could not recognize a single leading edge in the Islamic movement. This was the bleak outlook which faced the Ummah as history moved into the final decade of the 14th century of the Hijri era. But the world was unaware of the Islamic movement in Iran, because the Iran under the ex-Shah was beyond the pale of Islam. Iran was a blind spot. We were Sunni, and our age-old ignorance was deep and total. Thus, when the Islamic revolution in Iran began to make headlines in the early 1978, the bulk of the Muslim who called themselves Sunni was caught unawares. The Shah's propaganda had then blamed the Islamic Marxists. The Western media and the Muslim media, manipulated by the West and the alienated regimes of the Muslim countries, had then dismissed the events in Iran as insignificant. All of us were slow in recognizing the new reality in Iran. There had been a systematic attempt at smearing Islamic Iran, and the Western media deliberately promoted false accounts of the events of the Islamic Revolution led by Ayatollah Khomeini, who is indeed the founder of the revolution, leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This campaign against Iran is nothing new. Right from the beginning, vested interests have carried on an unending campaign against the Islamic revolution in Iran. This evening, our guest speaker, Mr. Ahmed Diret, who is a distinguished scholar of Islam, who hardly needs any introduction to the public, and who has just returned from his trip to Iran, will present to us his first-hand account of Iran. I now call upon Mr. Ahmed Diret to speak to you.
قال رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي امري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقهوا قولي. اعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. لا وإن تتولوا يستبدل قوما غيركم ثم لا يكونوا أمثالكم. صدق الله صدق الله مولانا العزيز. Mr. Chairman and brother, whilst we are skeptically looking at the miracle of a nation reborn, Allah's inexorable decree is finding its fulfillment in the rise and fall of nations. In the verse I have just read to you from Surah Muhammad, the last section of the last verse, in it Allah Bari Ta'ala reminds us, warns us, that if وَإِن تَتَوَلَّوْ يَسْتَبْدِلْ قَوْمًا غَيْرَكُمْ, that if ye turn back from your duties and responsibilities, the obligation which Allah has entrusted to you, if you will not fulfill your obligation, then يَسْتَبْدِلْ قَوْمًا غَيْرَكُمْ, He will substitute in your stead, He will replace you with قَوْمًا غَيْرَكُمْ, a foreign nation, an outside people, another nation. Our Urdu-speaking brethren, they use these words so beautifully whenever they describe some mishap taking place in the community and talking about that foreign nation, they say غَيْر قَوْم, غَيْر قَوْم. Now it happens to be Quranic, قَوْمًا غَيْرَكُمْ, nation, foreign, غَيْر. It's actually the Urdu that we are using. At times Gujarati also is a ghair qaum. Ghair qaum means a nation other than yourself. So Allah Ta'ala says that if you will not do your duty, I will replace you with a ghair qaum, another nation. ثُمَّ لَا يَكُونُوا أَمْثَالَكُمْ, then they would not be like you. And this has been happening in history throughout, again and again. Allah Bari Ta'ala chose the Jews, the Bani Israel, as He tells us in the Holy Quran. Ya Bani Israel, askuru ni'mati allati an'amtu alaykum. So, O children of Israel, remember the special favors which I did unto you. Wa anni faddaltukum ala al-alamin, that I chose you, selected you above all the peoples of the earth for my special favor. That favor was that they should become the torchbearers of the knowledge of God to the world. This was the honor, this was the privilege that was given to the Jews, the Bani Israel. But because they did not fulfill that obligation, a Jew among the Jews, Hazrat Isa alayhi salam, as recorded in the Christian Gospels, he is made to say to the Jews that the kingdom of God shall be taken away from you and given to a nation bringing forth the fruits thereof. And that nation, we very, very happily own up, is the Islamic Ummah. It's taken away from the Jews and given to the Muslims. The Muslims among them, the Arabs at first, Allah gave them that honor and that privilege, and they became the torchbearers of light and learning to the world. But when they relaxed, when they failed to deliver the fruits, Allah Bari Ta'ala replaced them with another nation. In history, we remember the Turks and the Mongols destroyed the Muslim empires, and once they accepted Islam, they became the torchbearers of light and learning to the world. As Iqbal beautifully, he describes the situation. He says, Tu na mit jayega Iran ke Arab ke mit jane se, Tu, you Muslims, you will not perish. If Iran or the Arabs perish, tu na mit jayega Iran ke Arab ke mit jane se, nashay mai ko taluk nahi paimane se. That the spirit, the strength of the wine has got no connection with the container. It is not dependent upon the container. The container is our nationhood, our boundaries.
that the spirit of Islam is not dependent upon geographical boundaries or national limitations. نشے میں کو تعلق نہیں پیمانے سے ہے آیا یور سے تاتار کے افسانے سے. It is evident from the invasion of the Tatars by the Tatars, these Turks, these Mongols, ہے آیا یور سے تاتار کے افسانے سے باس با مل گئے کعبے کو سنم خانے سے. That the Kaaba got its protectors, its guardians from the idol worshipper. So this is what Allah Bari Ta'ala does again and again. He chose the Arabs. When they relaxed, the Turks. And when they relaxed, the Christians came and sat on their chests. And this is a continuous process. You don't do your job, Allah will replace you with another people. We are in the world today, 1,000,000,000 Muslims. 1 billion, we are boasting. And 90% of this 1 billion happen to be the Sunni world. We have stopped delivering the goods. Allah chooses a nation whom we all have been looking down upon. The Iranians, Shias. This is the word ever on the word of Shia. What is there among the Shia? What can you find? And history was very unkind to our brethren in Iran. That the Shah happened to be the ruler and his name happened to be Muhammad. Imagine, this Muhammad, you know, as one young poet described, ke koi Muhammad daka mare, koi Muhammad chor, jis Muhammad ka kalma pade, wo Muhammad aur. You see, it happens to be Muhammad, but the guy, really speaking, was not a believer. And it is hard for us to imagine today, once you visit that country and you find out, go into the details of what was going on, that this Iranian, the Shah, it seems as if he was a foreigner. If Hitler had conquered that nation and infiltrated them, whatever he did, if Hitler did it, we could understand. If the Russians conquered that nation, and if the Russians lorded it upon this people with all the cruelties, we can understand. But here is a man, he is supposed to be an Iranian, speaking the Persian language, and having the name of Muhammad, and what he stooped down to, what he did to the nation. We were equating Iran with the Shah, and the Shah with Iran. They were synonymous terms. But when you go into details, we learn that the Shah and the Iranian people were poles apart. Absolute foreigners one to another. Now about this visit and my impressions, let me begin at the place where I had the first fragrance of this Iranian brotherhood of ours. It happened to be in Rome. In Rome, you know, as Sheikh Saadi speaks about Gulistan and Bostan, the rose garden of Saadi. Now, I had the fragrance of Iran coming to Rome. First I smelt it, as well as some of my other companions, they smelt it in Rome at the airport. We were waiting to get on to the plane. There were some visa problems. And one of our young men was given the responsibility of overcoming this difficulty, and he goes to the Iranian air office. He handed over the problem to a young lady in the type of attire that you saw on video. You know, those young girls with covered faces, body well covered, beautiful, beautiful to look at. You know, the imagination we had about the chadar, you know, this is the word they keep on using, the chadar, chadar to us means a sheet. But when you look at these people in that attire, wallah, they are beautiful people. They look beautiful in that attire of theirs. So there was a lady in Rome, in the office, and she was attired in that Islamic garb of the Iranian Muslims. She was bespectacled. Had spectacles on, and the way she handled these matters,
So somebody came and told me, he says, man, if you want to see a real Iranian Muslim girl, and I went and some others went and we saw, and that was the first smell we had of the Islamic Ummah of Iran in Rome. Landing in Iran, we were taken to a 5-star hotel, which was there before the revolution as a Hilton Hotel. Now it's known as Istiqlal, Hotel Istiqlal. We were accommodated there, and we were taken around. We were taken around to the different places, places of interest, and I will relate to you some of these visits of ours going together, what you saw on video. I will try to describe the feeling that goes through when one experiences in real life. If I remember, I think the first big visit we had was to the Behist-e Zahra Cemetery. Behist means paradise in Farsi, and Zahra is the title of Fatimah al-Zahra, the daughter of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Zahra means the radiant one, the effulgent one. Paradise effulgent. This is radiant paradise. This is the name of the cemetery. And before going to Iran, I have been reading in the newspapers about Behist al-Zahra to the cemetery. When the Imam arrived in Tehran, the very first thing he did was he made a beeline for Behist al-Zahra cemetery. Now we're thinking, one goes to the cemetery, what for? To make dua? Yes. For the departed souls? Yes. And when you are imagining a cemetery, you are imagining something like Brook Street or Riverside. You know, we have our cemeteries. Brook Street, Riverside, and so on, Stella Wood. You can't imagine that this cemetery is square kilometers and square kilometers. You can't imagine it. You see, it is a big open ground where 1 million people, 2 million people can be accommodated. This is why they gather there. And they gather there because it is the easiest place where you can recharge your spiritual and emotional batteries. Because they lie. The martyrs, people who had given their life, 70 to 80,000 people had given their life in this revolution. 100,000 have been maimed in this revolution. Unarmed people with only Allahu Akbar as their slogan, they toppled the mightiest military force in the Middle East. So we went to this cemetery and 1 million people were there, men and women and children. 1 million! You had seen some scenes of it. We were greatly inspired. We were greatly moved by the enthusiasm and the feeling of our brothers and sisters there. That in the midwinter, this was midwinter when we were there, we are in midsummer here, there is midwinter there, that in midwinter, for hours on end, men, women and children were sitting there on the ground. No carpets, no chairs. They're sitting on the ground in midwinter. A nation that can endure that discipline for hours on end. You can imagine what Allah Bari Ta'ala, what destiny must have in store for them. A day or two later, on our program, we read Behist-e Zahra Cemetery. Again, the first time we had gone there for a lecture, and we had also seen the graves there, and people going and offering dua, and reciting poems of sorrow. But Behist-e Zahra again, and I felt that this was redundant. Why go a second time? I've seen what a cemetery is. But on a Thursday afternoon, I said, well, if everybody is going, it's not nice, you know, that I stay away in the hotel relaxing, then all my companions would be going there in the buses. So I also joined them. And I was very, very happy because the second time when we went, this was a Thursday afternoon, and a Thursday afternoon in Iran is like our Saturday afternoon.
See, Thursday afternoon and Friday. Friday is a holiday. So it's like our Saturday afternoon. And tens of thousands of people were there in the cemetery. This is a custom, a regular custom. Every Thursday, tens of thousands, you can't imagine, it's like an Eid. Every Thursday is an Eid in the cemetery. Like an Eidgah. And our Eidgah is a tiny thing compared to what I saw there. Tens of thousands of people are gathering there for what? To charge the spiritual batteries. A reminder, a constant reminder, don't forget, this man, this is my son, he gave his life for the cause. This is my brother, somebody says, he gave his life for the cause. My father lies here, and so on and so on. Now, with that kind of a system, every Thursday is an injection. Every Thursday is an injection, a reminder that they gave their life for Islam. We were taken around, besides this, Behisht Zahra, one of the biggest covered halls, I suppose, in Iran, 16,000 people. The biggest covered hall in Africa happens to be the Good Hope Center in Cape Town. 8,000 people can be accommodated. Here is a hall, 16,000 people. The Shah built it to boost his Aryan myth. He was boasting not only that he was a Shahenshah, the Shah, King of Kings, but he also happened to be, his own claim, Arya Mahar, the light of the Aryans. Now this Aryan sickness business, we haven't got the time to go into that, it would be another subject. What is this Aryan business? You remember Hitler? He claimed to be Aryan. He said the Germans were Aryans. Our Hindu cousins, the Desais and the Patels, they say we are the Aryans. If we were not Muslims, these Gujarati Muslims, you know, my people, we would have been boasting we are the Aryans. The Ex-Shah, the dead Shah, he was boasting he was the light of the Aryans. What is all this Aryan business? It's another subject. But he had built this as a monument. He had built another monument, costing millions, to commemorate a monument to Cyrus the Great, a pagan, a mushrik. His ancestor is boasting and priding about his ancestor, Cyrus, a pagan, a mushrik. In his honor, he had a monument built costing millions, squandering the wealth of the nation. This huge project, and that's in 1984, he was supposed to have the Olympics, World Olympics in Tehran. Boost his ego to say that, here you are, you see what I'm doing. We went and saw in this covered hall athletics, acrobatics, and wallah, you know, our people, you know, we are like jellyfishes. We have made ourselves into jellyfishes. We Muslims in South Africa, our young men, we do not participate in any of that kind of activity, what I saw there. Who does physical culture? Who does karate? Who does acrobatics? Not we. That's not for us. That's for the higher form. It's not meant for us, it's for higher form. Who does jogging? Higher form. You see, this is, you meet the young people here, I meet them, and when I shake hands with them, my own young men here, you know, like jellyfishes. Almost every young man you meet there in Iran, you know, he appears to be an athlete. You know, when you shake hands with him, you feel that you're shaking hands with somebody. Not jellyfish. Woman, you know, our hands, you know, like a womanish thing, you know, hard baby, you know. Like a piece of ham. Now, whatever they did, those acrobatics we saw, on world standard. And it makes you feel happy because they were not projecting Iran, that we are Iranians, we are Iranians, not at all. They're talking about Islam, about Islam, about Islam. There was not one semi-naked girl to do any feat for you. Not one.
Not a single one. Whereas under the Shah, if the Shah had his way and if he was alive, and if he had organized that gathering, it would be, you can imagine, all those follies, those Persian follies, you know, America, this Paris girls, you know, every Iranian daughter of ours, what you saw here on the screen, so beautifully attired, they would have made semi-naked for people to stare and feast upon. Everything Islamic. Strengthening the morale of the people, boosting them, men and women, you know, by the thousands, the 16,000, the place was too small. I don't know whether Hafiz Abu Bakr, you know, and Mr. Ismail Kala, they had taken all this trouble of making these videos. They have brought with them the amount of filming they had done, about 20 tapes they have brought. This one is a part of a 3-hour tape that you were seeing before the beginning of the talk. I don't know whether, Hafiz, did you take that athletic? I doubt it. You didn't have a chance. We were so rushed, you know, no opportunity. But we were thrilled. Wallah, we were thrilled to see our own children. So as we know, we feel that these are our own children, our own boys and girls, our own brothers, doing the things that we felt that only the Germans can do, only one, you know, the top grade athletes. Then we witnessed the military parade. Hours on end, young men, Allahu Akbar, passing through different groups of armed young men, and there seemed to be no shortage. There's no shortage of manpower. You know, if some of our young men feel that we'd like to go and help our Iranian brethren, they don't need any manpower. Alhamdulillah, they have enough manpower to do the job. They only want the tools, the weapons. They are making do with what they have. But if they had the same sophisticated weapons as the Israelis have, wallah, the whole of the Middle East would be freed from every type of foreign intervention in no time. This is a nation that can do it. The spirit is there, the spirit of jihad is there in each and every man and woman in the country. It seems that the whole nation is involved. When they're talking about 20 million people that they can put into the field, it looks like they're able to do that. If they have the weapons, the material, 20 million they can put into the field. In other words, every man, woman and child would be prepared to go and do jihad. We visited prisoners of war. Do you know when the war started? Iraq attacked Iran. The odds against the Iranians at that time, the country was in turmoil. And it was a grand opportunity to give a knockout blow, and they felt that the Jews did it to the Arabs in 6 days, we will do against the Iranians in 3 days. This was, the whole world was thinking in 3 days' time, within a week's time, Iran would crumble to pieces. And you know how long it has been now? A year and a half and more. And Alhamdulillah, that the odds that existed at the beginning, 20 to 1 against Iran in men and materials, they have turned the tables and they brought it down to 3 to 1, still against them, 3 to 1. And while bringing it to that level, 3 to 1, they have been able to push them back. They recaptured Suzangard, who visited the place, battlefront. They recaptured Bostan, Gulistan, Bostan. You remember the word Bostan. This was the kingpin in the attack against Iran on that front, Bostan. They broke the back of the Iraqi and they have recaptured Bostan. They recaptured a number of hill positions. Among them, you know, when I read the description, the name of the hill is Allahu Akbar. So we are thinking they recaptured Suzangard, they recaptured Bostan and Allahu Akbar. No, the name of the place is Allahu Akbar. Recaptured that. Alhamdulillah, they are doing a fine job. Allah Bari Ta'ala may give these people a little longer time to rectify the situation. Now, on the war front, you know, before going, Mr. Kalim Siddiqui, Dr. Kalim Siddiqui from the UK, he jokingly remarked when we were going, he says, man, you people got half a chance of becoming Shaheed. Half a chance.
because we were not really going to the battlefield. There would be full chance of becoming a Shaheed. We were going to the battlefront, so half a chance. It was a joke. But it nearly came to fulfillment. You know, sometimes you say something in joke and it seems to happen. When we were there, we visited Suzanbad, it's a city which has been deserted. Only soldiers are there. They recaptured it from the Iraqis, almost destroyed, fallen to pieces. But while we were coming out after visiting the scene, there was a big courtyard full of tanks. And our young men, they got off from the buses and they started climbing onto the tanks and they started taking snaps, something to bring and show it to you. So you see, we were on the tanks, you know. It gives you a great thrill. When will you have an opportunity of standing on a tank and having your photograph taken? So this is what they were up to. Me and Mr. Bawa, Advocate Bawa, we sat in the buses and now let these young fellows enjoy themselves. And something happened all of a sudden out of the whole group of tanks. One tank came right in the center of the courtyard. So we said, they are demonstrating to our young men, you know, how tanks move and maybe giving them a little ride. And then the fellow started shooting, tak 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 tak, you know, started tak 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 tak. So I said, maybe it's thrilling our young men, you know, so, you know, thrill them like firecrackers for them. But no, we find some of these young people dying into the tank, some going in the bushes. This is something serious. This is something serious. And we could see in the distance there some smoke going up there. We couldn't hear anything because it was quite a distance. And another, on the other side, something going up, smoke going up, and another place, smoke going up. You know, actually, we were under attack. We were under attack. Fortunately, me and Mr. Bawa, you know, the elders, we were sitting in the bus, but Hafizal, Advocate Muhammad, he saw the plane, you know, at a very extreme height, and high speed, you know, that fellow actually was trying to get at us, but you know, half a second difference. You know, the bombs all around us, Allah saved us, that half a chance. You remember Kaleem saying, half a chance, we nearly had full chance of becoming a Shaheed. Now, let me tell you something about, you know, visiting in Tehran, we visited the cripples. I'm sorry, the war wounded. But among the war wounded that we visited, we don't find anybody bewailing his plight. A man, both his legs amputated, no cut off. No tear. I never saw a single person shedding a tear. Imagine, and everybody is saying, willing that if it's possible, they'll go back into the front. And the only regret is, why we were not Shaheed? Why didn't our life was taken? Why was it not taken? This was the only regret. Not this. The regret is, why did I live? Why shouldn't I have died? You know, become a Shaheed. This is the ambition of each and every Muslim there. When we visited prisoners of war, the Iranians have captured something like 7,800 Iraqi prisoners of war. 7,800. And when we visited these prisoners of war, they seem to be quite healthy, well looked after, well fed, well clothed. Sheikh Najjar, one of our companions, he was interested to get first-hand information from the prisoners of war as to what they had to say about their condition. And he was given the opportunity to say, you just call any one of them. Anyone that you want, call him aside and speak to him in Arabic, because Sheikh Najjar could speak Arabic. And he had it from the prisoner's own mouth that they are being very well looked after. Then I had an idea that, look man, let me find out that since they are here for some of them 6 months, some of them for a year, some of them a year and a half, I wanted to know from every group, I'm asking the officers, how many people committed suicide, you know, since they have been caught here, since the war? He says, not one. Next group, how many people committed suicide here? Says, not one. How many, not one person committed suicide among the prisoners of war. Whereas, you know, in our civilized country, South Africa, 46 guys committed suicide in the prisons. In prison here, well looked after, well fed, well clothed, climatically we are in fantastic condition. 46 guys have committed suicide so far. Now this tells you, see, now this is a, it tells you that if a people will be persecuted, ill-treated, man wants to find easy way out of this life and suicide. More suicide among the 7,800 prisoners of war. Reason to meet the Imam. Imam Ayatollah Ruhullah Al-Musawi Al-Khomeini. We were about 400 of us. We waited for the Imam, and the Imam came in, not too far, about 10 meters away from where I was. I saw the Imam. He delivered a lecture to us for about half an hour, based on the Quran, nothing but the Quran. The man is computerized with the Quran. And when he came in, when he walked in from an outer room, you know, the electric effect it had on everybody. That charisma, what is a charisma? You look at the man, and without any thinking on your part, tears start rolling down your cheek. You just look at the man and you tear. I never saw a more handsome old man in all my life. No picture, no video or TV can do justice to the man. The handsomest old man I have ever seen in my life was this man, Imam Khomeini. Now his name, you know, there's something unique about his name. Number one, he is called Imam Khomeini. Now to us, Imam is a very cheap word. You know, whenever we go anywhere, it says, who is the Imam of the Masjid here? You know, we have Sheikh and Imam in the case. We call them Maulvis and Maulanas here, they call them Sheikh and Imams. Now to the Shia, I have to also explain to you what the Shia business is. But to the Shia, there can be no Imam. There is only one Imam they are waiting for, is the 12th Imam. You see, they believe in Imamat, that the Imam should be the spiritual leader of the Ummah. And the first Imam, according to the order of Imamat, is Hazrat Ali radiallahu anhu, first Imam. Then comes Imam Hassan, he's the second Imam. Imam Hussein, third Imam. And so on, it carries on till we come to the 12th Imam, Imam Muhammad. The name of that Imam, the 12th one, was Muhammad. And he happened to be about 5 years of age when he disappeared. And they are expecting his return. They use a term, the learned men among the Iranians, occultation, that he has gone into occultation. Something like a spiritual hibernation, you know, going into some spiritual condition in which, like Ashab al-Kahf, you remember reading the Quran about Ashab al-Kahf, something like that, that he is gone and he is going to come back and he is the living Imam. He is going to come and he is the only one you can call an Imam. No other Imam. They have no Imams. Everyone among them, the learned man, is a Mullah. Mullah means a Maulvi. And Ayatollah means Allama, the great Alim. When they say Ayatollah, it means, in their terminology, Ayatollah is Allama, the great Alim. Mullah, Maulvi, and Allama, the great Alim. No Imams. And yet, Imam Khomeini is an Imam. This is very, very unusual for them to call him an Imam. Because for 1,000 years now, a few hundred years, there is a program, no Imams. The only one who can declare jihad is the Imam. No Imam, no jihad. And that 12th Imam, the hidden Imam, he hasn't come yet. They're waiting for him. But somehow, you know, it is accepted by the whole nation, Imam Ayatollah Ruhullah Al-Khomeini. Ruhullah is the name that his father gave him when he was born. And you know what it means? Ruhullah means the spirit of Allah. This is the title of Hazrat Isa alayhi salam in the Quran. That's his title. Ruhullah. Then he is Ayatullah, means the sign of Allah, is also another title of Hazrat Isa alayhi salam in the Quran. So he is Ayatullah, sign of God, he is Ruhullah, the spirit of God, Al-Musawi, coming from the family of Musa alayhi salam, Al-Khumaini, and from Qum, the city of Qum is Khumaini. So they accepted him as the Imam, and he has declared Jihad, and the whole nation has accepted the Jihad. They are not waiting for the hidden Imam. But there is one great thing about this situation, that people are talking, suppose he dies, he's 82 already, he had had so many heart attacks, and time will come, our Nabi went away when he was 63, he has been given so much extra long inning, he's 82, today, tomorrow, next year, 10 years. Busy. We keeping ourselves busy, you see. My son, and he must die. And if he dies, what's going to happen to the Iranian people? Will they go back to sleep? No, no. As if by some mysterious power, you know, everything that the people are uttering is a safety valve, is a guide, a protective method. The coming of the Mahdi preserve Khomeini. Until the coming of the Mahdi, so the real thing that they are waiting for is not Khomeini. They want to clear the stables. You see, Khomeini put it to them. He says, look, when the Imam comes, we are all expecting, the Sunni world, we are expecting Imam Mahdi to come and clean the table for us. You know, make us masters of the world, make us to sit on the thrones. The Sunni world is waiting. Until then, you know, we can carry on with our petty little squabbles. What we are carrying on now. Keep busy. We keeping ourselves busy, you see. It's only the Imam Mahdi can come and do the job for us. This is we, the Sunni world. Khomeini programs his people. He says, no man, when this poor Mahdi comes along, you know, after all this waiting for centuries, whereabouts, in the cave, in hibernation, wherever he is, imagine you putting him to work. We must clean the world for him, that when he comes along, he can sit back and relax and say, well, Alhamdulillah, the job is done. So the nation is now geared to do the job. They are waiting for him to come and sit on the throne, not to do the job, not to do jihad. They must do the job. Whereas we, the Sunni world, we are waiting for Imam Mahdi to pull the chestnut out of the fire for us. So if Khomeini goes, the goal, the ideal remains. And the ideal is the coming of the Mahdi. Now, you know, there were a lot of people with us from all over the world. And I found types and types of people, sick people. You know the types of sicknesses, the mental sicknesses. I came across an alim from Pakistan, Maulana Sahib from Pakistan. Now he found that there's something wrong with all these things that are going on there. Because you see, in Iran, if a person is lecturing, you know, like as I have been lecturing here, suppose it was an Iranian audience. When I use the word Khomeini, the whole thing stops. The whole audience of a million, they will begin, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. 3 times. Every time the word Khomeini occurs in a talk, 3 times they must send durood on our Nabi Kareem sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. But during the course of the lecture, if the name Muhammad occur, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, then 1 time, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad, once. When the name of the Prophet occur, 1 time durood. When the name of Khomeini occur, 3 times durood. So the Maulvi Sahib, he says, man, you know, look at these people. Look at them. What kind of Muslims these are? When the name of the Prophet comes, they send durood once. And when it comes the name of Khomeini, they send durood on Khomeini twice. I said, what do they say? What do they say?
I want to know from the Mullahs, what do they say?
This Durood al-Khomeini.
This Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. I said, who's Muhammad? Khomeini?
Since when was he? Who named him Muhammad?
You know, but the sickness, can you imagine a learned man, but you know, the minds are so prejudiced. You are looking for force.
Aha, you know the Shia people, you know, when they make salat,
our brothers are telling us, he said, you know, they have a piece of clay, and they make sujood on that. So, it seems like something shirk they're doing. They're worshipping the piece of clay. So why don't you ask them? Why do they use a piece of clay? What is the logic behind it? You see, the first time when I experienced this, it was in Washington, D.C. The Iranian students there, they invited me to deliver a talk to them. And it was Isha time, men and women, the boys and girls, who were studying in America at the time, we made salat. And of course, everybody was given a piece of clay tablet. I felt a little uneasy, naturally. Anybody, any first time you come across a thing like that, you know, somebody gives it to you, so what are you going to do with this? You know, it feels so funny. So I put it aside and I made my salat with the Iranian students. And I wanted to know more about this. I said, what is all this clay business? Now, what do you want to carry that little thing? Wherever you go, they carry it in the pockets. So the logic of this clay is this, that we are supposed to make sujood on Allah's earth. We say, going down with the forehead touching the earth, we say, Subhana Rabbi al-A'la, Subhana Rabbi al-A'la. We say, touching the earth. We say, there's nothing wrong with that. If I describe it, if I tell the non-Muslims, well, when we touch the earth, prostration, we say this, touching the earth. But this is, what you are touching, according to the Shia, the way he's programmed, is not earth, is the carpet. And the carpet is man-made. You see? So, he wants to be true to that expression. He has been programmed from childhood that we must touch the earth. And what earth can be better than the earth from Karbala? Now, this is the logic. He's not worshipping the thing. But now, this is something we always make fun and mockery about the Shia. But on my way out from Tehran, in the plane, across the aisle, there were a couple of Shias. I didn't know that they were Shias. But one of them, he took out from his pocket a handkerchief, and he opened it on the flap, you know, on which people have their needles and things like that, in the plane. So he opened the handkerchief, and there was a clay tablet. And Allahu Akbar, he was whispering, praying, uttering. Then he went into ruku, back, and then sujood, onto the clay, and again, and sujood, onto the clay. You know, he performed the salat. We see some of our brothers, you know, they sit down and make salat in the masjid. Similarly, this brother was doing that, but, you know, sitting on the on the plane seat. And when he finished, he gave this to his neighbor and he did the same. Of course, this is for us a big joke, is it not? Huh? But imagine, we were dozens of Sunnis on the plane. Out of the dozens of Sunnis, only one young man made the salat. And that wasn't me. That wasn't me. Right? But you're laughing at the other guy. That guy is going, he's doing something, he's doing better than you. But no, no. Now we must sit in judgment. This is, you see, now he doesn't do like us. He's not as polished or as refined as we are. You know, we Muslims in South Africa, we are very polished and refined in our salah, wallah. You know, the Arab is no patch to us. The Arab is no patch. The Iranian is no patch. The American Bilalian, you know, the new converts, the Negroes, they're no patch to us. I have been with them. With the Arabs, you know, you are in the ruku, and the guy will give you a push to make space. And in the ruku... No, look, maybe it's valid. Look, we don't know. We don't know all these technicalities, because if you knew, I don't know whether you know, that between the four mazhabs, the Sunnis, Hanafi, Shafi, Maliki, and Hanbali, between the four of us, there are 200 differences in salat alone. Did you know that? 200! But now, we take it for granted because we are programmed. The Shafi says Ameen loudly, we say silently. He starts with Bismillah loudly, we say it silently. There's no trouble. There's no trouble between us because we were told, you know, as a young boy, my father was repeating a certain formula which he had learned from his father. He said, Charo mazhab barhak jaan, dalil charon ki hadith Quran.
that all the four Muslims just think that they are equally valid, and the proof of all these four is the Hadith and the Quran. So we accept it. So whether he's a Shafi or a Hanafi or a Maliki or a Hanbali, we are tolerant. But here comes the Shia. So you see, he's out. Because we are programmed so. So that guy is out. Whatever little idiosyncrasies he has, we can't tolerate. But we can tolerate the Hanbali and the Maliki. You know, there are things that they have 200 differences between us and them. 200 among the four Muslims. We are very tolerant. I said, why can't you accept this brother also? This is the fifth one. And the astonishing thing is that he is telling you that he wants to be one with you. He is not talking about Shiaism anymore. He is shouting, La Sunniya wa la Shiiya. La Sunniya wa la Shiiya. Wahda, Wahda Islamiya. There is no Sunni and there is no Shia. There is only one thing is Islam. There is one thing is Islam. But we say, no, you are Shia. He said, this is the sickness of the devil. It's Shaitaniyat. They want to divide us. Even imagine, we, the Sunni world, we are 90% of the Muslims of the world, 90%. They are less than 10%. They say they are 10%. The 10% want to become partners with you in the deen, one with you. You 90% are terrified. I can understand why should you be terrified? They should be terrified that they'll get absorbed in the 90%. But you are terrified. I want to know, why should you be terrified? When he says, with open arms, and when you look at the people, the feeling that they have for you, you know, going to the Jummah prayer, 2 million people, a million people there, about 500,000 women and children. You passing by, and they're just looking at you. You know, they recognize you from this attire of yours that you are a foreigner. You are not one of them. And tears start rolling down the cheek, just looking at you. This is the feeling they have for you. But we say, no, we want to keep them out in case they absorb us. You can only be absorbed if there's something better than what you have. If you change, if you become a Shia, I don't know whether you call me a Shia, I'm still with you all here. You see? But what is this Shia Sunni business? Wallah, it's all politics. This was political in the beginning, and which some people exploited and kept it up, kept it going. And among the Shias, there are Shias and Shias. You know, there are types and types of Shias. Among us, the Sunnis, there are types and types of Sunnis. Haven't we? We have some of our brethren go to the Qabristan, and they make sijda on Bashabi's Qabr. Tell me, no? Huh? Would you say he's a kafir? What would you say? If it's your father, if it's your grandfather, what do you say? He said, bichara, nahi janta, you know, jahil hai, Allah isko maaf kare. Right? Because he's yours, he's your father, he's your uncle. But if a Shia does anything, which is also, we say, serious, you're going to condemn the whole Shia community, the whole nation of 35 million people, you want to say that they're all rubbish. If one Shia does something, or one Shia says something, and there are types and types of Shia, that there are types and types of Sunnis. One group of Sunni, they say the other guy is not a Muslim. The other group of Sunni, he says, you are not a Muslim, you are a kafir. He says, you are a bidati. Look, that's among us. And we're fighting among ourselves. And some of us doing funny, funny things. A brother of ours, very educated, in Newcastle, I visited him. Somebody introduced me, he said, look, when you go to Newcastle as a commercial traveler, that was. He said, when you go to Newcastle, you go and see Mr. So-and-so, and you say, I sent you, and inshallah, he says, everything will be made easy for you. So I went to the man, and exactly as I was told, he took me home for lunch. And while I sit seated at the table, I see on the wall there Burak. You know Burak? It's like a donkey-like animal with the face of a woman, beautiful woman's face, that's supposed to be the steed on which our Nabi went for Miraj. A donkey-like thing with the head of a woman. So while seated at the table, I say, kya hai? You know? I said, this is not right, man. You know, Burak, Bark means electricity, like electricity in Arabic. So that steed, Allah made it of some electrical force, molecules, whatever it was, you know. You can't make it equated with this donkey with a woman's face. You know what he did to me? I can't forget. But he's a Sunni. He's my brother. Still my brother. You see? So this Sunni Shia business, wallah, it is the work of the devil. Now, my dear brethren, I don't know, there might be things that you want to know specifically something about Iran. What I found was that it is Islamically orientated. The whole nation is geared towards Islam. And they're talking nothing but the Quran. I have had not a single experience talking with an Iranian where the man contradicted me when I'm talking the Quran. Whereas our Arab brethren, wallah, again and again, you quote them the Quran and they contradict you with the Quran. They're supposed to know the Quran better than us. But the Iranian, he seems to be on the wavelength of the Quran. Everything that he's doing, everything he's thinking about is the Quran. You remember Tabas? The American people, when they wanted to free the hostages. The mightiest technological nation on earth. A nation that can land a man on the moon and bring him back. A nation which tells you in which part of the moon they will land and they come back. They send the Mars and Jupiter probes. A nation that warned Pakistan about the Bay of Bengal tragedy. There's a tidal wave coming. They didn't heed the warning. They warned Israel in 1973 that the Arabs are on the move. They didn't heed the warning. That nation couldn't land in Iran. Imagine. They go and bang themselves one another and they smash themselves and they run away and leave their dead. Imagine. A nation that lands on the moon and comes back, they can't land in Iran. And this Iranian people, wallah, they were not in a position to do anything to them. They could have done what they wanted to do. I went and saw this American embassy in Tehran. You know, you imagine some big building, you know, but man, it's acres and acres and acres right in the center of Tehran. They could have easily landed with the helicopters and got these people out, even if they lost a few men. They could have done what they went to, how to do. It was well planned. But, you know what happened? Fiasco. Retreat. The Imam is told what had happened. He doesn't say, Subhanallah. He doesn't say, Alhamdulillah. You know what he said? سَأَلَمْ تَرَ كَيْفَ فَعَلَ رَبُّكَ بِأَصْحَابِ الْفِيلِ. These are the words that came out of his mouth. This computer. Don't you see? كَيْفَ فَعَلَ. What has happened to those people? أَصْحَابِ الْفِيلِ. The companions of the elephant. And what it is? You know what you call those huge helicopters? Jumbo helicopters. Those big planes, what do you call them? Jumbo planes. You know what is jumbo? Jumbo is Swahili for elephant. Did you know that? In Swahili, jumbo means elephant. That's how they got the name, jumbo. Like Simba. Simba. You know, Simba means lion in Swahili. So there was Simba jet. Let me show you the picture of a lion. Jumbo jet means elephant-sized jet. Jumbo helicopter means elephant-sized helicopter. So these elephant-sized helicopters and elephant-sized planes went, and this man says, أَلَمْ تَرَ كَيْفَ فَعَلَ رَبُّكَ بِأَصْحَابِ الْفِيلِ. You see, the companions of the elephant, you know what happened to him. But now we are so skeptical, the Muslim world has become so skeptical, we don't believe in the Quran really. You don't believe in the Quran. This is all for entertainment. See, for spiritual good feeling that you can get by reciting, we have recited, mashallah, the Holy Quran, you know, for spiritual blessings, yes. But the directive that Allah Bari Ta'ala has given you, nobody seems to care. May Allah Bari Ta'ala make these brethren of ours, the torchbearers of light and learning today, to the Muslim world, and to the non-Muslim world. And here is a nation geared to do the job. When you look at them, the earnestness that is in them. A nation that is not afraid, you know, it terrified me. Wallah, I tell you, terrified me when you see those things there. They say, Mard Barg America, death to America. We get the jitters. See, now he's provoking that big devil. Bala Shaitan, you know, Bala Shaitan is interfering with the Bala Shaitan. And the Bala Shaitan is big enough to give you a side swipe and go to make you to go to sleep. He's capable of doing that. Isn't he? Mard Barg America. Then it's a Mard Barg Shorvi. Death to Russia. Imagine. You know, one big devil there, another big devil here, said death to this fellow and death to that fellow. And death to Israel.
Can you imagine a nation doing that and surviving it all? Not afraid, not in the least.
If this is not the spirit that Islam, you know, the Islamic spirit that's permeating their hearts and minds, they are not talking about an Iranian revolution. There is no Iranian revolution. They are talking about Islamic revolution. It's Islamic revolution. If you ever utter the word Iranian, there's an Islamic revolution. This is not an Iranian revolution. It's a revolution for Islam. And little wonder that the nations of the world can't stomach it. It is Islam that they can't stomach. So, my dear brothers and sisters, you know, I have taken so much of your valuable time already. If you have any questions, maybe I might answer them myself. And I also have with me, you know, stalwart young men in the case here of Hafiz Abu Bakr, an advocate, and you know, I have briefed him that in case, you know, you make things too difficult for me, then he can bail me out. So with these words, I take leave of you to sit down and open the meeting to questioning.
Change in the attitude of the Iranian people, and particularly the government at the government level, and also at a population level? Is there a change in the attitude to the family of the Shah of Iran? Or is there still a price on the heads, such as the wife of the Shah of Iran and the daughter and the son and so forth?
You see, now this thing you can only judge. You can only see what is happening there. When, if it was your child was murdered by the Shah, Savak, if your child was mutilated, the eyes were taken out, the limbs were cut off, then how you would feel towards the Shah and what was happening there when the whole nation was being exploited, billions and billions, you know, that has been taken out of the country, see? Put into the what they call Pahlavi Foundation, in his personal accounts, in his relatives' accounts. Billions. And besides that, besides the loss of the money, is the physical torture that the people have been inflicted upon. For 16 years, they couldn't make Juma. A nation that was deprived of making Juma for 16 years by the Shah. That nation, how does it feel? How does it feel about what has been happening to them? See, when they talk about America, we can't really evaluate, you know, the feeling, because we haven't suffered. It's all, everything to us is hypothetical, you know, things might have happened and what not. I don't know whether you've seen this Umar Mukhtar, the Lion of the Desert. Right. Now, you see, when we are reading stories, people are talking about what happened to the Muslims, what happened. You can't visualize, you can't imagine, because you never experienced any such thing. But when you see what the Italians were doing, and if the Libyans, if they had the chance of, you know, taking revenge, then you and I, we have no right to sit in judgment. Because we haven't suffered. The things that they went through, we didn't go through. So how they feel, I mean, I didn't ask any Iranian how he feels towards the Akshar family, I didn't ask anybody. But I can just imagine that if the things that has happened to their sons and daughters and fathers and mothers, you know, at the hands of the Shah's stooges, then how you would feel. I think that that thing is something that we can't sit in judgment to say how they ought to.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The question which Mr. Yaqub Mir put, it presumes that the Shah's family is not interfering with the internal affairs of the Islamic Revolution. If that is the position, which factually is not, and secondly, if there is repentance from the Shahs or Faradiba or members of the family, then obviously people in Iran are guided by the ethics of Islam, and that is to consider. But that is not the position beyond a shadow of doubt. Quite apart from what the Shah had been doing for 36 years as a willing puppet and a stooge of the United States and other powers in destroying Islam as a way of life. In right in the broad daylight of history, in events in 1978, the Shah gave direct orders, receiving orders from the President of the United States, Jimmy Carter, in shooting down and massacring 50,000 Muslims who simply wanted to live their lives as Muslims and to be guided according to the dictates of the Holy Quran. Not a single paper, including these so-called papers, objective papers in South Africa or any part of the world, recorded what happened on September 8, 1978. In what is now called the Shahid Square or Shuhada Square, no less than 5,000 men, women and children, unarmed, who simply had a rose in their hand, who were appealing to the soldiers, come back to Islam. The orders were given that they should be massacred and mowed down by American bullets. This was also with the connivance of all the embassies in Tehran, which includes Britain, France, Germany, and the United States. Not realizing the extent of this man's criminal activities, and when 35 million people united together in calling for the ousting of the Shah, the United States continued in having substitutes appointed. Shapur Bakhtiar and Shamim Amini and various others. General Owaisi, who is now hanging about between Washington and Iraq. SAVAK agents in continuously mowing down to a point where helicopter gunships were used. When we went to Behisht al-Zahra, 100,000 people had been buried there. All these have come a matter of 24 months because they wanted to live their life in freedom and as Muslims. When the Shah left, he looted and plundered. This man, Rockefeller, all of these people blocked the 14 billion which you know already. Quite apart from that, I have here with me documents from the U.S. Embassy. These establish beyond all doubt the criminal activities of the United States even after the Shah had left. All of this indicates exactly the interference in the internal affairs of the Islamic Revolution. Directly with the collaboration of the Shah's family in Egypt. Anwar Sadat was also party to this. So was the Saudi family. So is Iraq, Saddam Hussein, Jordan, and so on. The position is still the same. That the billions that have been looted and plundered is now used in preparing this attack which Saddam Hussein carried out under the direct instructions of the United States. One must see. Firstly, there was evidence, and obviously it will need an entirely one day in itemizing, item by item, with documents and proof of the criminal activities of the United States for 36 years, even contravening international law. This question of hostages is absolute rubbish. They were not hostages, they were spies, beyond all doubt. But apart from that, the United States brought the Shah in, as you know, and then the hostage question came in April. They planned the Tabas expedition, which is again already referred to by Brother Ahmed Bidat and what had happened. And when that failed, and when it was a humiliation for the United States, the Carter administration announced that something big is going to happen. What was that something big which they wanted to say to the American electorate, because the elections were coming in about the end of the year 1980? That big was getting people like Shapur Bakhtiar, Owaisi, all the Shah's men, and 5,000 soldiers who had being in the time of the Shah, enjoyed all the privileges and so on, to have training in the borders of Iraq to plan a preemptive strike against Iran, and hoping that a blitzkrieg would bring about the end of the revolution. This document shows, even before that, Saddam Hussein saying to the United States through the ambassador, whatever happens, I don't want the clergy to be in power. He wants a kind of person who will accept the domination of either of the superpowers, and we are back to square one. The usual agreements would carry on, it's a one-way traffic, cheap raw materials, and so on. One must remember that the highest value held in the Western world is the standard of living of the Western man. That is the highest value. You are judged a success by the kind of house you have, the kind of cars you drive, and the kind of business that you have, not by your nobility, not by your humility, your example, and so on. In the Islamic world, it's completely different. Therefore, according to their own people, Harold Brown, the former defense secretary, in February 1980, he gave a report that our standard of living, the well-being of the United States, depends on three things. The import of cheap raw materials, number one. Number two, the export of consumer products at maximum profits. And thirdly, the maintenance of a situation where we get maximum profits for our foreign investments. If these three things are combined, you have a situation where the economic well-being of the citizens of the United States is preserved. Now, there are two energy houses of the world. The one energy house is the Persian Gulf, the other one is Southern Africa. And, of course, there are other areas like South America. It is necessary, therefore, implicit in the whole culture, policy of the United States, that a kind of regime be sustained that allows cheap raw materials to come out, not to the benefit of the local indigenous population, but at the lowest possible prices. Hence the corruption, the bribery, the kind of filling of the pockets, and the best way is not a democratic state or a state where the people participate and have their say. The best is a dictatorial regime or a kind of monarchy where the person, one man, is the authority. Hence their policy is not to see democratic development. Policy is to see repressive, brutal regimes from Saudi Arabia, from Bahrain, from Iraq, and all these places, including the Shah, be sustained as long as possible, and the people are kept continuously ignorant. The second is to arrange through briberies and so on, exports at maximum prices, so that they do not give a kind of infrastructure to that country, so that country can develop its own TV. It must become dependent to the oppressor. And therefore, if the TV breaks down, it has to go all the way to Paris, all the way to Britain, all the way to the United States to be repaired. Alternatively, the spare parts must come there. Do you know in Saudi Arabia an ashtray? I'm talking about an ordinary plastic ashtray, which costs 1 cent in the United States, is sold to the Saudis at $11 by the Americans. This is in the University of Dahran. You can see that one barrel of oil in 1973, I think, was about $11 or thereabout. In 1973 also, I spoke to one advisor to economic affairs and so on, and he put it in a very simple terms. He said, look, this is the value. That same country sells us a barrel of Coca-Cola for $40. So you can see the inverse process, that even the multinational companies with billions of dollars profits. And the third one, to maintain. Now this had come to an end when the Shah was removed. The looting, the plundering had come to an end. they needed a foothold. And from June, when the Carter administration announced, brothers, I can tell you, I'll quote you newspaper, date, time, country, as far as this aspect is concerned. Something big is going to happen. Don't worry. They're telling the Americans because they were humiliated. And that something big was the Shah's men, General Zahidi, that Liz Taylor's boyfriend, and others went to Iraq 6 visits. Shapur Bakhtiar made 6 visits. And when from there he entered the United States, he saw the Carter administration. 5,000 people, Khuzestan and all these areas, interruptions were, you know, instigations and so on to bring the Iranians into a point where they're unable to contain themselves. All this started taking place, and then the Iraqi, Saddam Hussein, the defense minister, met with Crown Prince Fahad and the King Khaled and their defense minister. On 19th of August, 1980, the American Secretary of State went to Europe to see the various ministers to explain to them that something's going to happen. Britain withdrew its embassy, closed its embassy and withdrew 1 week before the attack. And on the 22nd of September 1980, the Iraqis struck in a front of 520 kilometers. And the world's press, the imperialist media, which was a fought estate, the real front for Western interests to secure the so-called Western standard of living, was ready to say that Iran is now going to crumble. And Bakhtiar announced 1 week after the attack a provisional government, hoping for Khomeini's government to go. The Times of London, all these newspapers were making sinister suggestions. Joseph Kraft, a CIA journalist, a confirmed CIA journalist, writing in September 1980 in the American newspapers, it is an opportune time for America to invade. There is at the moment continuous efforts being made to undermine the Islamic revolution. And all this is coming from the scum and the rubbish and the remnants of all those criminals who had been having a good time. These are the ones, the generals, the Pahlavi family and others. And they are even doing this at the very moment. They have, the Pahlavi family, contributed only 2 weeks ago $500 million. To Western journalists and reporters to report favorably the Iraqi situation. Because right now, although Mr. Didat did not point out to him greater details, 80% of the land has been recaptured. They can not only push back, they can invade and reach Baghdad in 24 hours. But they have no quarrel with the Iraqis because they are brothers. It is the Ba'athist regime, the anti-Islamic, anti-Muslim government of Iraq that needs to be put down. And all of these countries, so-called Muslim governments, who are right now spreading the word around that this is a Shia revolution and this and that, they are actually striving in the same way that in the time of the Prophet Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam, the Confederates, the Qurayshis, the Hashimites, and all the other monarchic elements had combined to destroy the Islamic State of Medina. This is precisely the situation at the moment. And that therefore, brother, answers your question, really. How can, in the light of this, deliberate, calculated criminal activity being perpetrated against a will, common will of 35 million people, that 35 million suddenly must have a change of attitude against these people? It is a continuous offense. What struck me really, brothers, is the degree of tolerance. Having witnessed such crimes committed, that it is a crime against humanity, that quite frankly, brothers, a dossier must have prepared that not a single one of them must have any place under the sun until he's brought to justice. Now, in such a kind of situation, do you know in Susan Garrett, Not a single building is standing. Is this a war against soldiers, or is it a deliberate, calculated destruction of citizens? In Awaz, we saw from the airport when we incidentally we had gone in a military aircraft, I think it was a C-160 Hercules, and we went to Awaz. This is the place continuously bombarded by Iraqis and so on. The weapons are provided for by the Americans through Saudi Arabia. $40,000 million, in other words, $40 billion was given by these petrodollar states to Iraq to fight and kill innocent men, women and children. This is a fact. And this in Susangerd, we went from Awaz, 45 kilometers, we saw Iraqi tanks blasted, and the Iranian brothers had adopted a very astute military tactic when they were caught unprepared. As you know, they had economic sanctions imposed on them. There's a fifth column there, which has been all but wiped out. The Munafiqeen Khalq, this party, also supported by the United States and so on. That here, what they did is they diverted the Karun River. So the effect it had is that it flooded the area, so the Iraqi tanks all submerged and bogged down in the mud. Quite a few days, they were able to halt the advancement of the Iraqis and then gradually managed to push. But why was the delay? That's another aspect which people should know about. It was the Munafiq Bani Sadr. He wanted the collapse of the Islamic revolution in the sense of the Islamic Republic based on Vilayat Faqih. That is the distinction in the Islamic constitution of Iran, that the guidance of the constitution, or rather the guidance for the nation, is to be by an alim who is recognized amongst all alims, because the Islamic system of government is not the type of things that are bandied about, the experiments and the versions at one, and sometimes even us in through some degree of ignorance also say that Islam is a democracy. That's absolute rubbish. Islam is not that. Islam is not a theocracy. It's not a democracy. It's not an oligarchy. It's not a system based on the proletariat. It's not based on the wealthy class. It's not based on the priestly class. It's not based on the poorer class. Islam is Islam, given by Allah, and Allah therefore is the authority. Man is the responsibility for that authority. He must implement that authority. Therefore, as one professor whom I met very brilliantly formulated, the Islamic government is the government of Allah by people for Allah. Therefore, all of humanity is a community of equals. But that is another question, as somebody might want to know more about it. And therefore here in Bani Sadr's role is that he wanted a republic, not a monarchy, but a republic not on the authority of Allah. That's what, and therefore he was disappointed that the people elected the alims. And they are of course very pious and humble, and they manifest the true qualities of Islam. Now, he then, as commander-in-chief, violated his provision in the constitution as chief executive officer in directing the soldiers to Karam Shah and other areas, and not in the areas that really required defense. He was hoping that the Iraqis would create an intolerable situation by being entrenched in Iran, and obviously they destroyed the vital areas like Abadan and the refineries and so on, and hoping that they would economically cripple the Islamic revolution. The people will then criticize the alims as incompetent, and the alims are not doing their job, and look what you all have done for us. From a situation of economic prosperity, we are now in a worse situation. And this is what he wanted. But when he found that that didn't happen, The reason, because the revolutionary guards. These are the brothers now that Brother Ahmadinejad also touched upon. That the revolutionary guards are young people who have completely given themselves to the cause. And I have never before, quite frankly, seen such dedication, such inspiration amongst these brothers, that I even said to some others, when do they get the time to eat? When do they sleep? 24 hours. They are holding the whole structure of the situation in Iran, here, there, and everywhere. And not forgetting their salah, not forgetting their cause, and even on their show, in the uniform, we saw Ya Tarallah among the young boys, 13 and 14, 15, 17 years old, defending the cities of Suzangarh, of Awaz, of Despur. In spite of all the artillery fire and so on, they're holding on. Young boys defending mosques, and they can strip a Kalashnikov rifle in 15 seconds. You know, they know about it. These are the revolutionary guards that were amiss, were in fact responsible for holding the Iraqi invasion, allowing the army to really get together because they needed logistics and so on, and now they were able to work hand in hand. And that now is the situation, dear brothers, that under no circumstances whatsoever must anybody be under any misconception that these munafiqs and criminals, there's no other word for it, and murderers are leaving Iran to decide its own destiny. They're continuously doing it, and the kind of rubbish that you are reading in the papers must be looked upon as nothing but rubbish. The question of torture and executions and so on, there's nothing of that kind. Do you know, brothers, and I think I'm anticipating a question, so I might as well answer that if you don't mind.
Well,
the question of executions and so on, there are some video recordings by Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, by the judges themselves, by Ayatollah Khalkhali. You know, the Western media had dubbed him as the hanging judge. He was with us and we met and we...